Sally Dixon, and I'll continue the trend of the last few speakers by asking an unprepared question. It just occurred to me, as the speaker one was speaking, that as we looked at figure 6.1, we saw the diversified industry sectors. And does this offer any solution, albeit even maybe a partial one, to the very earlier speaker who was concerned of the double jeopardy problem? Perhaps by investing in sectors that are diversified from your actual company sector, you reduce that double jeopardy, and I'd be interested to hear views on that.
Michael Pomery. I too wasn't planning to say anything tonight, but as an ordinary pensions actuary who's attended many trustees meetings over the last 30 years, I was reflecting on some of those meetings. Over the first 20 of those 30 years, the way trustees set about investing the assets of a pension fund, they totally ignored the fact that there were any liabilities there. And that wasn't as daft as it sounds, because at that time they were all very immature, they all had positive cash flow, and indeed they had positive cash flow as far as the eye could see going forward. And what has changed over the last 10 years is the increasing maturity of those funds, and an increasing realisation, firstly amongst advisors and then amongst the trustees themselves, that actually those assets are there to meet liabilities, and it's not just an investment pool to play around with on the stock market. And this increasing maturity gets reflected in changes in the basic split between equities and bonds. And during those first 20 years, many trustees built up their equity proportion to 70, 75, 80, even as high as 90% in equities. And by the time they put a bit in property as well, there was only a tiny bit left for bonds, maybe 5, 10, or at most 15%. And so all the effort in the trustees' meetings took place in discussing with the investment manager the equities. And it's, in any event, it's a lot more interesting discussing equities with these guys who came down from the city to your trustees' meetings than it was discussing bonds or gilts. But it does seem to me that given the changes over the last 10 years, we're all going to have to put a lot more effort into understanding bonds and bond markets and investment in bonds. And once the bond proportion builds up in pension funds, which it is doing already and will continue to do in my view, then it's inevitable that everybody's going to start looking for how do we make a bit of extra return on our bond portfolio. We won't just invest in gilts, we'll look at corporate bonds as well. And it's interesting to watch trustees and their attitude to risk when the bond manager comes along and says to them, well as having gilts, we think we should have a few corporate bonds in this portfolio. And they all suck their teeth and say, isn't that a bit risky? There might be some default there, and should we really be moving out of gilts into corporate bonds? And this is from trustees who've still got 75% of their fund in equities. And so there's a big education job that needs to go on there, and I believe, I'm convinced that it's started, certainly amongst the bigger clients of the more sophisticated trustees. One of the things that surprised me a few years ago when I started looking at this for the first time was just how big the corporate bond market has got, and it came as a shock to find that corporate bonds in this country had overtaken gilts in terms of the size of the market. When I was chairman of the Pensions Board a few years ago, one of the last things I did was to set up a little working party who last year produced a report which was intended to be a sort of introduction to corporate bonds for pensions actuaries, and a very useful paper it is too. And I think pensions actuaries and investment consultants are going in future, if they don't already, need to have a much deeper understanding of bond markets and that than they have in the past. And it does seem to me too, looking at this, that fixed income investment is a classic area for actuaries. It's you need to be highly numerate and you need to understand these things. So I think Paul's paper tonight is a very useful contribution. One further thought that went through my mind, and David Linnell has already touched on this, if UK final salary schemes are going to start investing a much bigger proportion of their assets in bonds, as I believe they are and will do, and if with the move to DC schemes, when all these members of DC schemes start retiring and buying annuities, and when, as I suspect will happen, more and more final salary schemes start winding up and trying to buy out annuities from insurance companies, the demand for bonds is going to quite possibly exceed the supply, or maybe the supply will grow to meet the demand. And the Finance and Investment Board is doing some interesting work in this area, and so it's watch this space, but I think I look forward to seeing what they come up with. Thank you.
And don't forget, there's a weight of equities in with-profit funds and insurance companies also waiting to go the same way. So. Any more? Anyone in the council chamber? Okay, then I shall ask Michael Deakin to close the discussion.
Well, somebody who worked as a fixed income fund manager from really the late 70s through to the mid 90s, I've been quite interested in the way in which pension funds have started to move back into fixed income in recent years. I don't think there's any correlation, before anyone starts doing analysis, between me stopping doing it and pension funds starting buying fixed income, but maybe there was. I think the overall case for why pension funds want more fixed income has been pretty well rehearsed, although it's clear that maybe it's not fully agreed by every member of this room that that should be the case. Certainly pension funds have got more in fixed income now than they had 5 or 10 years ago. Although today's Financial Times had an article about the mix of the typical balanced pension fund, and it doesn't seem that they have actually moved in that direction very much of late. I thought this paper was a very interesting contribution to this broader debate in that it has explored the case for broadening out from just government bonds into corporate and even high-yield debt. And I take it that there were one or two comments earlier on that there's a much broader range of assets that could be invested, and that's true, but we've got to start somewhere, and I think this is a very useful contribution to widen the field. And I particularly like the way in part of the paper where assets and liabilities were brought together, because I think that's much more important than just looking at the assets in isolation. Most of my comments will come from a practical point of view. I say from a practical fund manager from some years ago now. And in that case, why would anyone, doesn't have to be a pension fund, why would you want to own corporate bonds rather than government bonds? I think this very simple rule of thumb would be because you believe the extra yield you're going to earn more than compensated for the risk of default. Certainly the data shown in the paper looking at the US and the fact that income on a mix of corporate bonds exceeded that on governments would suggest that has typically been the case. And my own experience of the last 20 or so years in the UK would say much the same would be true if you modelled the UK data. Why have we been paid more than we ought to have been for owning corporate bonds? Well, part might be down to liquidity. There have been a few comments about liquidity in the course of this debate. But I think for a lot of pension funds, and certainly for the types of fund modelled in the paper, liquidity is not that important. The only time you'd really want liquidity in a corporate bond was at the point when you had to stop holding it because it had defaulted or been downgraded, and that's the last time you'll get liquidity. So I think that you've been paid for liquidity which isn't actually that important, so that's one area where you'd be able to capture some value. I think the other point, which one of the previous speakers brought, I think it was Peter Raines mentioned, was about the economic background. There is a link, which the paper didn't really pay too much attention to the behaviour of corporate bonds and the economy. And I think actually there's quite a significant pattern, which can go back much longer than the 18 years in the paper, which shows how corporate bond spreads between very top quality and mediocre quality have moved along with the economic cycle. So as the economy strengthens, we should expect these corporate bond spreads to narrow as the risk of default appears to diminish. It's been there. The current pattern we're going through looks very similar to a pattern of the previous 30-year cycle. I think it's a fairly well-established one. So the fact that we have lived through a very long period of sustained economic growth in the Western world would be another reason why corporate bonds have in the past been a good place to have put your money. But that's looking back, not looking forward. My own personal view, which you can take or leave, is that at current yield levels, the extra yield we earn on corporate bonds is not that attractive, certainly on the longer dated stocks, and I'd be a bit more cautious about the future excess return we will earn than about the returns we have earned over the past few decades. As I said, this is partly about the analysis looked at a very short period of data because of the lack of data on high yield debt in particular, and therefore misses some of those points. But I was also surprised, as one or two other speakers were, about this apparent lack of skew in the data that was coming through. My own feeling was much the same. And one of my principles when I was managing these types of fund was you could lose all of your money, or a very large part of it. At the best, you'd gain that extra piece of income for the life of the bond. And it seemed that the balance of risk and reward, although the risk of default may be quite low, the downside risk was much higher than the upside gain. And I also felt we were often having debates with companies who wished to reschedule their debt in some form. Being paid an extra 0.25% for a much less secure piece of paper wasn't necessarily a good trade-off. And the other point in the UK has been that we've actually had a market where generally institutions have been pretty strong on making sure they've got good security on corporate bonds. That has helped the process. It is different from the practices we'd see in Europe or in the US. Moving on now to high yield debt, I wasn't surprised at the outcome in the analysis in the paper, which said there was a stronger correlation between high yield debt and equities than there was between high yield debt and bonds. It was how I had seen this market when I was a practitioner. I have to admit that I was actually an investor in high yield bonds back in, I suppose it was 10 years ago, just after the period that Derek McLean was asking about. What happened in the early 90s that caused this distortion? Well, I think some of you may remember a man called Michael Milken, who was operating in a fairly strong way in the late 80s, and I think there is some link between the sheer volume of low-quality bonds that were issued in the late 80s and the very high default rates in the early 90s. The default rate in 1991 of US high-yield debt reached 12%. The average over the last 20 years or so has been about 4.5%. A similar pattern emerged about 10 years later. I'm not suggesting by any way that there's a 10-year period cycle going on here, but in the late 90s, we again saw a very large increase in the volume of what we regard as low quality. And here I'm talking about low quality within junk bonds, so I'm talking about the very poor end, but a very large increase in the volume of new issues of low quality, high yield debt. And 3 years later, 2002, the default rate had risen to 11%. I think there was another piece of data, if I just refer to, I think we probably have a moment, is of the 125 issues that defaulted around the end of the 1990s, a quarter had been outstanding for less than 12 months before they defaulted. So it gives you some idea of the sort of market we're operating in. That does not mean that you can't make money. And certainly an investment made 10 years ago after we'd had all those defaults, when the yield premium on high-yield debt was in excess of 1,000 basis points above treasuries, would have been very, very profitable. What you want to avoid is investing when everyone else has been buying them and the yield premium is much, much lower. And that brought back to me a piece of research I read as a young fund manager, but one that stuck with me for more than 25 years. And it came from the US, and it was headed, I think, get the words almost right, I hope, "More money has been lost in reaching for yield than at the point of a gun." And the message of this was, more people have really tried to get some extra return. And I think that's been a little bit of a theme here tonight. How can we get a bit more? Well, the clear answer is, you only normally get paid more by taking on more risk. That risk might be credit risk. It might be you're investing in a company that's much more likely to default. It might be liquidity risk. But somewhere, you won't get paid something for nothing. And the typical cycle would be that as yields on what we might regard as safe investments, whether they're bank deposits or government bonds, have fallen, investors start to look elsewhere. They start to look for what would have paid them that nice 7 or 8% they used to earn on treasury bonds they can't get any longer. And gradually they move up the risk curve until they meet where they find they can get the interest they want. And that has been part of this cycle we've seen in the high yield debt market, that the interest in high yield, because it was a substitute for the no longer high yielding, safer investment, caused yields to fall, yield premiums to narrow, allowed poorer quality companies to issue, and then inevitably the bust followed the boom and we go around again. That is not to say that I don't think there's a space for high yield at times in a portfolio, as I said before. Just to summarise, I think the paper concluded, I thought, with a very good point, which is to use swaps and other derivatives to manage duration. If we stick to the traditional, and by traditional I mean the sort of methods I was using 10 years ago, things have moved on a lot, of just buying bonds of the right duration to match the liabilities, I think we are restricting ourselves very severely. By using swaps to get the duration match as far as you can, then opens up a whole range of possibilities of places where you can invest the money to get that extra return. This could be through a corporate bond portfolio, selectively through the use of high yield. We've had one or two speakers questioning whether there will be enough debt out there if we all want to buy them. Well, I'm quite a strong believer that supply will meet the demand in time, but we don't have to restrict ourselves to purely UK corporate debt. Swaps would allow us to buy euro-denominated debt, a much, much bigger market, US-denominated debt, and swap the currency back. So the market, I don't think there's a shortage of supply, but there's plenty there. There's a lot more that could be done to develop this debate, but I think the author has made a very good start and has certainly started the debate as to how fixed income, in a broader sense, can play a part in pension fund portfolios. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. And I'll ask Paul to respond.
First, I'd like to thank everyone for all their comments, which were very helpful and very interesting. There are a few additional points I'd like to make, many of which have been made in part by other speakers. I'll be making them again, but some I hope will be drawing together some of the other people's comments. First, a comment on the data set used. Yes, it was US data rather than UK data, and as has been noted, this was because the US provides the largest consistent time series for bond data. It would have been nice to use UK data, and if I'm still doing analysis in this area in 10 years' time, then I might go back to it and apply some hopefully longer UK time series data then. There were caveats in the paper about the fact that it's US rather than UK. But I appreciate that those caveats might not have been strong enough, and there are a number of other areas that could be explored there. As far as the asset classes go, again, there are many other bond asset classes that could be analysed in this paper. I think, though, that the main ones were covered, that is, effectively risk-free, pretty much risk-free but a large market. Certainly quite a bit of risk there, and something completely different being equities. Looking at other asset classes, I'm not sure would have added that much value to the paper, particularly given the results of some of the analysis, that looking at an asset liability model, the additional information that you get from trying to model extra asset classes is pretty limited. Having said that, there is potentially quite a bit of additional work there for other people to do if they really want to, and I'm more than happy for this paper to appear in the bibliographies of several other papers. It might get a little better known. The second point I'd like to cover is on the skew in the returns of corporate bonds. Now, it's pretty intuitive that for an individual year's data, if you look at the range of returns on a series of corporate bonds, then those returns will be skewed, because you'll have the majority of the bonds will have a very small positive return, and one or two will have very large negative returns. If you're looking at the returns on an index over a series of years, then it's less obvious that you are going to get significant skew in that data. You will get some from the same effect, but the skew will be much less. And particularly if you're looking at the data set that I've used here, where long-term government bond yields, and if you're looking at the returns on corporate bonds, investment-grade corporate bonds, it's going to be government bond yields which drive those significantly. With those yields coming down, the strong positive returns that result from that mean that any skew from the odd default is going to be largely swamped by these returns. And I think that's why you don't get as much skew in the index data as you might expect. A third point I'd like to cover is on demand and supply. Now, it's been mentioned several times that the demand and supply of corporate bond markets are going to, by definition, be the same. Demand equals supply. And if demand increases, then the supply of corporate bonds will probably increase from companies as well. But I think it's important to take a holistic view on this, to look at the bigger picture. Any company which has a pension scheme invested in non-matching assets is going to suffer risk from that pension scheme. The riskiness of the company and pension scheme combined is going to be increased the larger the amount of non-matching assets there are in that pension scheme. So if the pension scheme starts moving into bonds, then it's going to be reducing the amount of risk for the company overall. It's effectively going to be reducing its leverage. Now, what this means is that if you then get more corporate bonds issued by other companies or by the corporate sector as a whole, because of this increased demand for corporate bonds, then it's only really going to be leveraging itself up to the position it was before. All you've really done is remove the equities from the pension scheme and replace it with bonds that the company has issued itself. It's spread around a bit, but the net effect of the economy is going to be pretty limited. And the main effect is going to be that any companies which do this end up paying an awful lot less tax in the long run than they would have done before. And I think this is an important point here, because a lot of people have talked about the increased move into corporate bonds from pension schemes and how this is going to make the equity market crash. And it's just not, because companies are just going to start changing their asset allocation, or rather their capital structure, from being equity-based to being corporate bond-based. I think it's also worth taking a broader view on this. The UK isn't an island. Well, it's an island geographically, but financially it's not an island. And Europe in particular is moving more into equities, or more into funded pension schemes. So, and Europe, in terms of investment, tends to be a lot less parochial than the UK and the US. So when the demand increases in Europe for investment assets, it's not going to be for just their domestic assets. So there's going to be an increased demand for UK equities from Europe. Now, the final point I'd like to make is on the fact that bonds are not necessarily the most appropriate investment for pension schemes. And I'll agree with this. Bonds are not necessarily the most appropriate. I think swaps are pretty good as well, and they make a pretty good alternative. And the growth of the swaps market is a very important development for pension schemes. And it's not just the standard swaps like inflation swaps and interest rate swaps, which are very, very useful, but things like LPI swaps are being developed, which means that the amount of residual risk is decreasing just down to the mortality risk. The thing is, if there is a demand for a synthetic product from pension schemes, then there's going to be investment banks out there which are more than happy to satisfy that demand. If there's anything that a pension scheme really needs, or if enough pension schemes need, they will be supplied by investment banks. Finally, I'd just like to say again, thank you for all your comments on the paper. They were much appreciated, and I hope that you found it useful. Thank you.
Well, as Malcolm Jones in his opening said, you attempted a Herculean task here, Paul, and I think it's a classically good actuarial paper by dint of one of the comments that was made by one of the speakers, which says he's given him some mathematical support and analysis for his intuitive thinking, and basically supported, except I think it was in the skewness of corporate bonds, and I regard that as classically valuable paper to be presented in this hall. So it remains for me to express my thanks. I'm sure the thanks of all of us to the opener, closer, and all those who participated in this evening's discussion. Now, as mentioned, this will be recorded in the British Actuarial Journal, and it will be helpful for those preparing the transcript. If you have any prepared notes, if you could hand them to Pauline Simpson or Maria Lyons at the back of the hall. The next sessional meeting will take place at 5 p.m. on Monday, the 23rd of February, and I'm slightly confused about what the title is. I'm not sure if it's a choice of two or what, but one, it's either Market Consistent Valuation of Life Insurance Business, or is Hedging Realistic Balance Sheet? So watch the advertisements to see which it is. Anyway, anything by Tim Sheldon and Andrew Smith is worth coming to, so come anyway. You're now warmly invited to continue the discussion and join me for a glass of wine in the council chamber at the back. But I would like to remind those attending the Gallio and other dining clubs to make sure they leave on time. I declare the meeting closed.